This is Sierra Dahl with Municipal Sustainable Energy Forum, and today we're going to talk about state restrictions and barriers on microgrid deployment. Our first presenter is going to be Baird Brown with Ecolyn Law. So, Baird, why don't you go ahead and start us out?
Sure. Thanks, Sierra. I suspect that lots of people on the call have their own frustrations already with trying to develop particular microgrids in particular places, but so forgive this if it's a little repetitious. There's a sort of a catalog of problems that arise for people who are attempting even single customer microgrids in some cases, and certainly multi-customer microgrids in many places. They begin with our 100-year-old utility laws and how they define utilities, which were originally conceived when they were adopted as folks that had a 100% monopoly on doing anything to do with the electricity in a specified territory. And you either simply can't be another one if you're in the territory, or if you do things that make you a utility within the definition, become a regulated entity and have to do all the things with regulation and so forth, even though you have, say, two customers. Those utility definitions have a variety of characteristics that cause problems. Most places, if I want to generate my own electricity on my own property and use it behind my own meter, I can do that. That's rarely interfered with directly, although the interconnection processes that that we'll come back to, even for that. If I want someone else to sell me power, you know, because I don't want to be the one who invests, I make use of investment tax credits. I'm a non-organization or a government, so I'm not a taxpayer, can't use investment tax credits, or production tax credits, as the case may be, for more likely for wind, for a lot of reasons, I may want someone else to build and sell the power. Even if I do that on my own property behind my own meter, in a whole lot of states, that makes the seller of the electricity into a utility. Kansas comes to mind, North Carolina. I'm sure there are a host of others. Even if you're allowed to do that, even if that's not a problem all by itself, if you locate the generating equipment on the next property and sell it to you, even though we are abutters, in a lot of states I can't do that, or in California I can cross one property line but not two, or I can't cross a public street. That's a very typical restriction that arises in state laws, or you need municipal consent to cross a street, which is usually not so hard to get, as turning you into a utility. And ownership of wires can grab you, and in particular, as states have deregulated, District of Columbia is an example. They redefine utility from somebody who sells power to somebody who owns wires that distribute power. So now if I have even one customer and I'm not the customer, I may become a utility. Now if the customer owns the wire and I just supply the power, that may work some places, not so much in others. And then when I try to serve two or more customers, I may become utility. Again, there are several gradations on that. There are a lot of states that have utility definitions that are written so that if I don't hold myself out as selling to the public, and states, getting a bad echo, is somebody not on mute?
You're kind of coming and going a little bit, Baird.
Well, let me...
I'm going to take you off the speaker. Does that work better?
That's a lot better. Yes, thank you.
Yeah, okay. Ownership of wires can get you in trouble. Serving two or more customers can be just impossible by itself, or... in New York, for example, when they adopted state law following the Federal Public Utility Regulatory Policies Act, they said that qualified facilities, that's basically renewable generators and cogeneration, can serve nearby customers, and they weren't any more specific than that. It's just sort of in the neighborhood, it's okay. But a lot of states, that's not okay, and there are extreme restrictions on selling to more than one customer. I was starting to talk about the notion that if you're not holding yourself out as serving the public, that could relieve you. And there's a bunch of case law in some states that sort of verifies that. As a general matter, those cases, I certainly haven't read them all, but tend to say that, you're selling to eight people and they're your neighbors and you're not advertising for sale to other people. You're not a utility, but even in states that have that background, I certainly run into cases of utilities threatening people that if they try and do it, they will be sued. And that's often chilling for developers of microgrids. There are often other kinds of exemptions that may exist in state law for selling. There's a common one that's for a landlord selling to tenants, or distributing power to tenants, although a lot of those are written in terms of, you're redistributing the utility power at cost. It's not really set up to be reselling your own power, or reselling third-party power. So, again, there are lots of ways in which that may not work, even though it looks like an appealing exception. If you haven't been tripped up by the utility definition itself, there are a lot of other ways that utilities or existing utility regulation can make your life complicated. Some of those are charges. Almost every state has standby charges that it can apply to. They don't usually apply to individual retail customers, but to any kind of commercial or institutional customer. And those charges those charges are oftentimes not well defined. In other words, they can be they're sort of judgmental, and they can oftentimes apply as if every piece of generation and storage in your microgrid went down all at once, and they suddenly had to apply your entire load. And they apply a standby charge to all of that, which is, the microgrid as a whole going down is far less likely than the grid going down, actually. If anything, the microgrids are more likely to be able to support the grid. California has something unique, as far as I'm aware, called a departing load charge that we're fighting with them about right now. Which basically makes people who leave to join a microgrid and buy their power from someplace else, then the utility pay the utility for supporting the fossil fuel plants that they're not going to, or contracts for buying fossil generation that they're not going to be able to use anymore. This sort of backward-looking idea, when the state, in fact, has goals to, get to 100% renewables by 2045, is just really bizarre and self-defeating. And finally, utilities can make your life really difficult over interconnection. And this is something that's, again, at the center of the current PUC proceedings in California over having a microgrid tariff. And there have been a lot of accommodations that utilities in California have made for individual small solar or solar with batteries, which solar with batteries may even qualify as a microgrid, although it usually can't, stay islanded for more than a few hours. The batteries, it just doesn't make sense to put in batteries that big. But for larger microgrids, there really is resistance and a lack of understanding about what, goes on behind the microgrid meter. I mean, there's an awful lot of, utilities just really don't have the sophistication that private industry and the folks who've been operating microgrids for a quarter of a century have developed.
We have a pretty good sized panel today, so we need to kind of.
I'm almost at the end here. Last two sentences. Utilities also sometimes, Hawaii Utility has done this, put in a rule that says you can't resell power at all, and that means that the microgrid can't buy any power and redistribute it to multiple customers. And finally, in lots of states, you could possibly do something like form a small local co-op to build a microgrid. But if we're going to empower folks to move forward, there's a lot of work that the utilities and the have to do to make this easier. Thanks.
All right. Super. Thank you. All right. We're going to limit it to about 3 minutes per person because we have several people on the panel today and we need room for comments. So, Bob Perry, do you want to talk a little bit about what's going on legislation-wise?
Yeah. First, I want to thank Baird for giving just an excellent overview of all the issues that are out there, and there are just a tremendous amount of them. I think that really the fundamental problem is that we have to make a fundamental restructuring of our energy system and our procurement process. I can only speak to California, but the PUC, recently came down with a decision requiring centralized procurement for resource adequacy, which once again requires everybody to run through the utilities to do to build or develop any power. And the real problem is that we're still tied to a system that casts the utilities in the role of procurement and generation, and we need to migrate them to a role of energy management and distribution and incentivize them to build the kind of infrastructure that can easily accommodate distributed energy and two-way power flows and stuff like that. Now, one huge problem in procurement is, they're still tied to their RFP, request for process procedure, and that doesn't really constructively involve communities. I had worked with a group to put together two bills to empower communities to integrate energy into their planning process, and I think until that happens, it's going to be very hard to be kind of proactive and strategic about local energy development, because first you need to be able to construct a plan and then go to the property owners and invite them to be part of that plan. Now, it's currently, they have an RFP, it's ad hoc, it's very disorganized, and the utilities really have no incentives to provide the infrastructure that would really facilitate microgrid development. I'm sure I'm past 3 minutes, so I'll just leave it at that.
All right. Well, you actually hit it right on the dot. So good job. All right. Larissa, you're here? Do a four and then a six.
Yeah, hi.
Sorry. Yeah, good. Go ahead. 3 minutes in. I just lost you, Larissa. I think you were good. I could hear you a second ago. Try it again. Four and star. Not back yet. I shouldn't have said anything. Try it again.
Hello?
Push. Yeah, now I got you. Okay, good.
Okay. Sorry. With the, do you want me to go or wait?
No, go ahead and go. About 3 minutes.
Let's see. Reconciling, putting together, and going beyond Baird and Bob. I think we need to look at this from both project level and then also market development level with respect to state restrictions and barriers. And, you know, in terms of what Baird laid out, those are, I do agree, main obstacles, and also lack of effective means for compensating services of microgrids, and lack of a consistent definition with respect to microgrids so you actually can take into account and differentiate the benefits that microgrids can provide. Across the United States, there's so much fragmentation here, and call it soft cost barriers in toto, given the different types of rules and regulations, this really cuts against, in terms of transaction costs, and cuts against microgrid development. But the other level, and I think this intersects with, interfaces with what Bob was going over, is the market development level. And here it goes into not just addressing what we need to modify or change kind of within the legacy parameters, but how to really fundamentally reform the legacy system so that microgrids, their benefits can be valued competitively, and they can, you know, really play on a level playing field in terms of traditional utility investments. And this is where we have to reexamine the cost of service regulation, rate design, the valuation and accounting methods, asymmetries of information, performance, the need for performance results, performance-based regulation. And here it's going to really realigning incentives of the utilities to come up to date with the new challenges, long-term customer value. They are not aligned at all. Here things have been very, very slow, but now with the states that are moving certainly even beyond 50% towards 100, it really becomes a necessity. Once you get this legislation, parties can no longer argue that the legacy system will be adequate. So we really got a, you know, platform to stand on, because there's no way you can move to 100% under the legacy system. So now we got to bring down the barriers within the cost of service, the utility revenue model, rate design, the planning and valuation to level the playing field, and make this transition in a way so that the regulators, parties will be able to fairly compare what the value of the microgrid services are against traditional, the value of traditional investments, so we can better address these problems and provide solutions for our new era. And in this, we really do need consistent means for valuing the costs and benefits of microgrids, distinguishing them from other distributed resources, getting greater granularity of information as to locational value, not only distributed resources, but distinguishing microgrids, and big area, getting equal treatment of capital expenditures and operating expenditures in terms of reforming the revenue model, as well as cost-reflective tariffs. And standard application, bringing in, accelerating the adoption of IEE standards, not only the 1547, but the microgrid controller standards have gone effective. These need to be moved along so that microgrids can enter spaces such in providing services such as non-wire alternatives. So both levels, the project development and the more fundamental structure reforms, and working these concurrently.
All right. Thank you. I have a couple people here who I'm not able to identify by phone number. So there's a 607-592-5518. Somebody tell me who that is. Do a four and a star. I'm sorry, Dan? Go ahead. I couldn't hear you.
David Kay.
Oh, hi, David. Okay. And then there's a 610-348-5632. Who's that?
And that's Charlie Howland, outside of Philadelphia.
Hey, Charlie. Good to see you.
Good to be here.
And then we have a 415-282-4288. And a 469-867.
Sorry, I was trying to unmute, Tara. This is Rosanna, 415.
Oh, okay, Rosanna. 469-867-7402.
This is James Orenstein in Texas.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
We have a few new members here, in case you haven't figured this out. 530-304-5100.
Oh, that's John Walter.
Hey, John.
Hey.
Good to see you. It's been a while, huh? All right, super. Okay. Yeah. Okay, good. We got a bunch of new people here, so just making sure. When I do this, when you enter the first time, I don't see your name on here. After you do it once, and the name will pop up for me so I can see who's in the group. And Craig, you're still here. Would you like to go ahead for a few minutes,
sure.
And we'll open it up to conversation here?
Sure. Yep. This is Craig Lewis, Clean Coalition, and I'll go down the list of key issues that I see for microgrid development, and then I'll talk about a couple of solutions that I think are low-hanging fruit. So the first one is net metering is just really poorly suited to microgrid development. You have an on-site load limitation. In other words, you can't put solar or whatever renewable energy resource bigger than your amount of energy you consume over the course of a year. That's the on-site load limitation. And that's a real big constrainer especially if you want to use microgrids for resilience. You want to get as much, solar on that site as you possibly can. And I'll talk a little bit about how I disagree with Laird on the fact that solar microgrids can bring tremendous resilience. But obviously, the more solar you have, the more resilience you're going to have. The other issue with NEM is that you have, the other two issues are you have basically owner-occupied constraint. When you have a property that is not owner-occupied, it's really hard to make NEM work. You have what's called the split incentive issue. And then you finally, you have the split meter issue, right? Apartment complex, condominium, compound, whatever. You are going to have, when you have split metered a commercial building, right? You got a whole bunch of different meters in there. Whose meter do you stuff the solar behind if you want to use the rooftop or the parking lot to put a bunch of solar there? Split metered situations make it almost impossible to do net metering. Then you have net metering aggregation. It's supposed to solve some of those issues that I just talked about with net metering. The problem is, under net metering aggregation, you only get the energy value from one meter to the next. And net meter aggregation is a California term, so I'll explain that. It basically means that if you have 2 meters on the same site, you can kind of aggregate them together. But the meter that you're not connecting behind, any meters that you're not connecting behind, the aggregation is only for the energy value. Well, more than half the value of energy nowadays is in demand charges. You don't get those credited. You only get the energy value. And then the T&D, the transmission and distribution, the delivery charges, are even bigger than the demand charges, right? So you miss three-quarters of the billing opportunity to aggregate under an MA. Exactly the same issues under the virtual net metering, by the way. So people that go, oh, well, you can't use an MA, use the RESBTT program in California, which is a virtual net metering program, same problems, right? You only get the energy value. There's constraints on energy storage in the interconnection. Laird mentioned the energy storage, the interconnection issues. There's new standardized interconnection streamlining that was just approved last week at the California Public Utilities Commission. If you want to interconnect solar and storage, DC couple them, it's the standardization is for up to 30 kilowatts on the solar. They only did small projects, but up to 30 kilowatts on the solar, and it can only be paired with up to 10 kilowatts on the storage. If you're DC coupled, your rating is by the inverter. You're sharing an inverter. How can you have different ratings for your solar and your storage? It's completely stupid. I can't believe that people in California that were paying attention to the policymaking bodies let that get by. Right? That was just a landmine that was set by the utilities. There's limitations on using the self-generation incentive program. It's limited to a multiple of the peak load, right? So you get the maximum incentive if you have up to two times your peak load in terms of energy value. So if your peak load is over the course of the year, if your peak load is 100 kilowatts, you can have a 200 kilowatt hour battery, or you can get incentives, maximum S-chip incentives on 200 kilowatt hours. Okay. That works really well for a load that's really intermittent, right? It has really high peaks, right? Then you get to maximize your incentive. If you have very flat loads, you're going to be screwed because you're going to be limited to a really tiny battery relative to your load. Also, SGIP only works for behind-the-meter batteries, right? You want to come out in front of the meter and provide for a whole community, provide service to a whole community, SGIP doesn't apply. So I want to just say that, I mentioned the solar microgrids. You can get indefinite solar-driven backup power to a big percentage of your load, and you have to size the solar and the storage appropriately. And you can do it where you can get cost economic. This is exactly what we're doing at the Santa Barbara Unified School District. We've got 15 sites that are going to have solar microgrids, and we're in the middle of the RFP process. And I encourage you all to look that up. There's a lot of information about it out there in the public domain, including a lot of news coverage. Santa Barbara Unified School District, solar microgrids. What we could really use, we had all those constraints of net metering and net metering aggregation, what's called NEM-A. We had all those constraints. We could get around all those constraints by having feed-in tariffs. Feed-in tariffs would allow us to oversize the solar and make sure there's an economic way for that solar to get monetized. I think that there's a couple of people who mentioned the Rule 18, which is the sharing, at least in California, that's the sharing of the microgrid services between properties. I just say really quickly that is a limitation between non-adjacent properties. There is no workaround for non-adjacent properties. There is a workaround for adjacent properties that aren't separated by a right-of-way. Public right of way, and that workaround is that as long as your microgrid is not getting any energy from the grid, then you're fine. So if typical installation in California solar microgrid, you're charging your battery 100% from the on-site solar, behind the meter microgrid, you're going to get 100% of your energy storage charged by the on-site solar, and you can then take that energy out of the battery and you can push it to the next-door neighbor, right, over the fence. You can do that under Rule 18. What you cannot do discharge that battery from the grid and then push it over the fence, right? So you've got to make sure you configure your solar microgrid the right way, which is how they're almost always configured, because if you don't get 100% of your energy into the battery from solar or an on-site renewable, you're not going to get the tax benefits on the battery either. So there's a lot of reasons why you want to make sure your batteries are 100% charged by the local renewable, which would then allow you to share that energy with your immediately adjacent neighbors. But if you want to go one property removed, you know, all bets are off. You can't do that, right, under Rule 18. Okay, that's it for me.
All right. Clina, do you want to add something to this? I don't know if much is going on in your area in Virginia, but if it is, there's something you would like to contribute as far as regulations are concerned. Do a force and a star. Oops.
I just want to say that we're in the infancy of this. We just passed the Clean Energy Economy Act this in April, and we're just starting to get our feet wet, and we're finding some stuff that the legislation got passed with the assumption that the governor would amend some of the glitches in it, and then we had COVID-19 and he couldn't. So there is going to be a lot of activity in this area. It just is in the infancy right now.
All right. Charlie Holland, do you want to – I didn't pronounce your name right, did I? Go ahead, Charlie. Anything to add on this?
You've got me mid-bite, but in terms of my geographic knowledge, Baird definitely trumps me. I just say that yesterday I was part of a forum sponsored by the basically International Trade Administration Select USA, whose focus was, or what we were talking about, was trying to attract basically foreign capital to microgrids as resilient infrastructure. So I guess, you know, stay tuned, but I'm part of an effort that's looking for ways to have foreign capital, international capital, be part of that private capital source structure that many on the phone are talking about in terms of, you know, how you can bring in funding for some of these. So that's sort of a vague offering, but that's already all I've got. And with respect to regulations, you know, anything I know, I probably learned from Baird.
Okay. All right. We have a 631-871-8877. Lynn, is that you? Number here that I'm not identifying? Yeah, it looks like your number. Lynn, do you have anything you want to add on this in New York? Do a four and then a four and a star to unmute your phone. Oops, sorry. I don't know how it got muted, but it did. I'm not able to unmute your line. I have no idea why. There we go. Lynn, are you there?
Yeah, that's me. Hello, everyone, from Southampton, New York. No, I have nothing to add at this time. I mean, we did participate here locally in the New York process. We got to the second round, but because we don't have any gas lines under the ground, we were not able to move ahead. But the town, we've got some underpinning legislation on our books, our comprehensive plan that enables us to do a project with a microgrid, which we would very much like to do because we have a whole bunch of other issues. But, you know, the funding is really the primary obstacle for us at this point. So I'm anxious to learn what I can from the group and see how we can move the initiative forward.
All right. Is there anybody else in the group here who has relevant information about legislation or regulations in their area that we haven't covered? Okay. All right. Well, let's open it up to discussion among the panelists to start out with. Go ahead and comment. Baird, I guess Craig had an issue that he said he did quite agree with you on. Do you want to comment on that?
I don't know that. I don't know that I want to comment. I mean, it really. I'll frame it anyway. I think what Craig is saying, and I don't disagree, as an engineering matter, that if you oversize your solar and storage, and you get any kind of daily insolation, you know, sooner or later you're going to be pretty long-term reliable. I do disagree with him about feed-in for May, because I think I agree with Larissa that you have to accurately and fairly value services to and from the microgrid, and I don't think that subsidies generation the right way to you know, let microgrids provide long-term resilience, and I am in favor of using other forms of mostly fuel-based generation to provide flexible generation within microgrids. Right now, in a lot of cases, it would be natural gas, but sooner or later, it's going to be hydrogen or other things that people are working on. The last thing I'll add is that through the decarbonization legal pathways to deep decarbonization project led by John Dernbach and Mike Girard and now Rich Horst has pulled together a website in which all these different recommendations for deep decarbonization have been assembled, and you know, draft legislation is being done on a pro bono basis by a lot of law firms. A Yale law student has volunteered and done a complete 150-page survey of the state laws governing utility definitions and the exceptions that I was talking about, and we're probably weeks or maybe months away from, you know, having that all reviewed. You know, my initial review is that it's fabulous, and hopefully before too long we'll be able to get that available up on, you know, the Pathways website, which would be a great good thing. And then Charlie, despite his deferring on his considerable expertise, his firm has taken on starting to draft legislation, model legislation that would do away with some of the barriers and allow the distributed generation state by state. I'll give you one anecdote from that project. That is that Nevada did something which is dear to my heart. They enacted a legislation that was sort of a community and, a customer bill of rights for local renewables, and the PUC said, oh, yeah, well, the legislature enacted that, but that doesn't mean you can't sell to two people without being a utility. So we have a ways to go.
Yes, it sounds like it. So I'm going to open this up to anybody else who has not had a chance to talk to ask any questions relevant to regulations on microgrids or comments in your areas.
Sierra, this is Lynn. Can you hear me? I have a question.
I can. Sure. Go ahead, please.
How do CCAs intersect with microgrids? I mean, do they enable? Are they outside? You know, what has the group seen in New York State? I'm sorry, not New York State, across the country. I'll just add that, by the way, we're putting up, New York State has, as you guys know probably, there's 100 municipalities in the state that have passed the enabling legislation, And I happen to be part of the group that brought it to Long Island for the first time, and we're looking to stand up the first CCA program later this week, later this year, rather. I'm sorry, I'm being distracted. So I'm curious to know if the existence of a CCA can move the needle forward on microgrids.
Anyone?
This is Baird. I'm taking up all the airtime, but others may add. But the CCAs, most places, are set up to be buyers of and resellers of power for the entire community which they serve. They're not designed to do things for subsets of members of the community. The kind of thing they can do to encourage microgrids is be buyers of the excess power output of the microgrids. And there were certainly discussions around that with the Santa Monica microgrid and the CCA in the LA area. People are thinking about that, but they're not set up to be developers of microgrid projects usually.
Yeah, and this is Charlie. Let me throw another two cents in, and maybe this, since this is my first introduction, I don't have a full sense of the sophistication of the audience, but let me give this a shot, which is that CCAs is sort of a way to bring, as I see it, a way to bring in sort of a competitive retail supplier, typically a supplier who's going to promise to get their energy on the wholesale market from renewable or otherwise more socially benign sources. And that's kind of it. Whereas a microgrid happens typically to get its, but doesn't have to, but generally the ones we're talking about, is looking to get its power from a socially benign or better source, think solar combined with battery. But it really is more focus on some of these other benefits of microgrids, the resiliency and reliability that is sort of a little bit beyond the purview of the better buying choices that are typically the prime goal of CCAs. Let me stop there and see if anyone would agree or disagree with that. Thanks.
All right. Craig or Larissa?
I guess it will depend on how the CCA is designed because, well, thanks to Sierra, we've been having, you know, from Sam Golding, loads of sessions on CCAs and how he's been trying to evolve changes in the CCA design model, regionalization, enabling the community to be empowered, to really set up, its be in charge in the driver's seat on setting up how the financing, portfolio diversification, et cetera. And, you know, if you move in that direction, I think you can begin to recognize greater benefits of microgrids and pull them more into, you know, the community procurement. But as we've also heard in all those sessions, California is really the only place where this is taking place because, like, I think the speaker from New York was going over all the downsides that he was experiencing, exposed to in terms of how New York is moving along, and it's in a very traditional fashion, you know, bulk retail supplies, and same with Illinois. So I think we're a long way off, but parties are beginning to observe what is taking place under Sam Golding's and others' efforts in California on the CCA. So I think there's some hope.
All right. Craig,
yeah.
You want to comment on some of that? Go ahead. Yeah. Go ahead.
This is Bob Perry. I see a powerful role for CCAs to play, particularly, as Larissa said, in community empowerment, because they are generally regional. They span across multiple counties, and many communities don't have the resources to really be able to apply to integrate energy into the planning process. CCAs can help them with that. They can also be an advocate and spokesperson for those communities. And also they can be an aggregator. They can sponsor programs and aggregate resources in order to get economies of scale in acquisitions for local energy projects. So I see them as playing a pretty pivotal role once a lot of these regulations get either removed or substantially changed.
Bob, that's the California model. You know, that's
yeah.
the problem. You know?
Well, and we're not there yet. Yeah.
Let's see if we can get back to CCA in regards to microgrids. Craig, do you have any comments about that?
With respect to microgrids, let me make one overarching comment about CCAs, you know, which is, in general, I think they're good because they create competition in the marketplace. And we all know that utilities are pretty happy with the way things have worked in the past, and they're not too excited about changing the way that works for them. So they're typically, their inertial, you know, they have a lot of inertia to keep things the way they are. The CCAs shake that up a bit. In general, though, CCAs fall in the same trap that utilities do, right? Because of the way the policies and market mechanisms are set, they're buying almost all of their energy from really far away, coming over transmission, super expensive transmission lines, and they're afraid. They're afraid and they're constrained by their economics because they will lose their customers if their prices start going above the incumbent utility. So they've got this you know constant threshold they need to keep their pricing under, and you know for at least the majority of their customers that aren't the ones raising their hands going, yeah, I'm willing to pay a premium for you know local and for green and for you know resilience, you know green resilience. The CCAs, you know, once they get more established and they start, you know, banking some money, they can put some local programs together. There's, you know, very limited examples of that in California, but they're all saying the right thing. They're all saying that, you know, as soon as they get more money in the bank, they're gonna launch some pretty creative, you know, local programs, and microgrids are on everybody's list, you know, eventually. I haven't seen anything useful in terms of a local program that enables microgrids from CCAs. But I will stay, and I'll circle this. This will be my last comment. I'll circle back to something that Baird said about feed-in tariffs. And I, you know, Baird and I get along really, really good. We obviously disagree on this point with feed-in tariffs. The Clean Coalition designed a feed-in tariff for City of San Diego. And we designed that to have a dispatchability adder, which means it was really targeted to combine solar and storage on built environments, right? So rooftops, parking lots, parking structures. And by the way, the feed-in tariff is a public document. Everybody can download it and learn from it. Just go to the Clean Coalition website, type in San Diego, and it will, you know, get you to the right materials. But this feed-in tariff design we did for City of San Diego was in large part to see if SDG&E, the incumbent utility that serves San Diego Gas and Electric, whether SDG&E would move forward with a program that would truly unleash local renewables. And guess what? They wouldn't. And that was, SDG&E would not move forward with the feed-in tariff program, and they hadn't moved forward with anything else very useful for local, you know, unleashing local renewables there in the city of San Diego. And that input, right, being able to see SDG&E's reaction was a contributor to the decision by the City of San Diego to move forward with a CCA, right? Because they said, if we do a CCA, we can do this feed-in tariff program. We could do other programs that bring local renewables. And so the fact that this feed-in tariff program that we designed for City of San Diego has a dispatchability adder, and it has a market-responsive pricing mechanism as well, which makes it totally as efficient or more efficient than running auction actually makes it way more efficient than running auction programs because you don't have the inefficiency of 97% of the people that put a bid in lose, right? That's what happens in auction processes, right? And you have all that inefficiency of 90%, 97% of the people wasting all that time, energy, and money that they put into putting proposals together. So the Scene and Terror for City of San Diego is beautiful. It attracts both the renewables and the storage paired with it. So you can start to tie these assets together to get microgrid and renewables driven resilience, and ultimately community microgrids that serve broad communities, not just individual facilities.
All right. Any other comments on this?
Well, this is Baird. I want to agree with Craig that auctions are not the right way to go, and you do need sort of a market mechanism that allows people to, whether we call it a feed-in tariff or not, it allows people to sell at the going value of electricity whenever they have it, and hopefully the going value will track storage and things will move the peak from the middle of the day to when the grid really needs the power.
So are there any thoughts about specific legislation that needs to be enacted in order to help move these microgrids forward? And what can be done about that?
Well, I guess, Eric,
go ahead.
Hi, this is Benny Hayden. I'm based in Atlanta. I'm new to the group. I'm a sustainability consultant. As relates to legislation, my question would be to the panelists, to this point, have you been able to connect with any legislators either on the federal or the local level who can become somewhat advocates for what you guys are trying to accomplish?
Yeah, Benny, I think that this is Craig Lewis. I think that, you know, having on-the-ground advocates is absolutely fundamental to having success in policymaking efforts. And, you know, the Clean Coalition is not active in Georgia at the moment, although we were involved in the feed-in tariff programs that got designed there, which are amazing examples of the tremendous, you know, power of feed-in tariffs, by the way. In terms of legislation in California, I think that one of the most important things that we need to do in California are number one, we need to force the utilities to divest their transmission investments, because right now they make 12% guaranteed ROE, return on equity, for transmission investments, which are 50-year assets. Right. They get to clip coupons at an ungodly return on equity guaranteed by FERC for 50 years. And distribution investments are only 8% for 25 years. So it's like you'd have to be stupid not to choose the 12% ROE for 50 years over the 8% ROE for 25 years, right? You'd have to be absolutely insane. So the utilities have this massive conflict of interest to invest in transmission, and what drives transmission more than anything else is central generation. So inherently, utilities are motivated to invest in central generation, which is far away from loads and requires transmission, which means they get to invest in transmission. So to me, that is the game changer that needs to happen, is utilities need to be forced to divest their transmission investments. And that makes them automatically DSOs, distribution system operators, focused at the local level. And when you do that, then you have lots of opportunities to make sure that there's programs for third-party ownership and all the things that Larissa and others care about. You know, the Clean Coalition, we don't really care who owns the stuff. We just want lots of renewables, and we want it to happen as soon as possible. And we want it to be local. We want lots of local renewables, and to get harness those renewables for resilience. The utilities should own some. Third parties should own some. We don't really care, right, who owns it. We care that we get this transition as fast as possible. So we've got to change the incentives of the utilities to make sure that they lose this massive conflict of interest that most utilities around the country have to invest in transmission by eliminating their ability to own transmission. And then the second really important thing is we need to force the utilities to do significant demonstration projects that include that are focused on community microgrids that cover entire grid areas, entire substation grid areas, like what we have in the Goleta Load Pocket in the Santa Barbara region of California. We've got the perfect opportunity to do the Goleta Load Pocket community microgrid, and there's lots of information on the Clean Coalition website about this, and show how this community microgrid works at the community level, not just at an individual site.
Yeah, thanks for sharing. The other comment I would make, and this is just a general comment as it relates to project development, my experience has been, the extent to which you can create public-private partnerships, that have a vested interest in the outcomes, the more probability of the project, being successful. I know here in Atlanta, there is a project pending with the local utility where they partner with historically black colleges and universities, one being Morehouse, one being Spelman. And so I think that is an approach that one can look at, because it would include economic development. It includes, I believe, they're incorporating some low-income populations into the project. So that's just a recommendation, as I said, just on general project development. And the extent that you can, develop these benefits, if you will, the more likely that, say, federal policymakers, local policymakers are able to get behind the project to push it forward.
I agree with you, Benny. This is Craig again, and then I'll be quiet to give other people some airtime. But I would just encourage you to look at the Clean Coalition website, look at the Santa Barbara Unified School District. A school district is a municipality, right? So that is a public, entity. So in effect, there's a public-private partnership going on for the solar microgrids going on to the 15 Santa Barbara Unified School District school sites. The other thing I'd encourage you to look at is the Goleta Load Pocket Community Microgrid that I also mentioned, also available on the Clean Coalition website. And if you want to talk, I'm Craig at clean-coalition.org, but I'd love to see if you've got some ideas for Georgia and see if there's ways for us to partner together to bring some good things there. And we've worked with Georgia Power and others, right, in the feed-in tariff that they've implemented, which is really a great one. So we have familiarity down there, but I'd love to see if you've got some ideas we could work on together.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you. I'll certainly follow up with you.
All right. About 1 minute left here, so go ahead.
This is Bob.
Efforts around the country to influence legislatures. I represent the Microgrid Resources Coalition. You could go check their website as well. We've been advocating in a lot of different states. But in California in particular, there are huge coalitions that are both talking to the legislature and to the PUC trying to get motion. And we're all in this together.
Exactly.
Sierra, could I just add one real quick comment?
Yes, please do.
Also, there's movement apace, D.C., elsewhere, to get the kind of legislative, like a connecting, like in D.C., it's called the Distributed Energy Authority Act, to set up separate entities, non-utilities, that can help in terms of different issues relating to distributed resource development within communities. And that type of legislation, I think, is needed to bring the community, empower the community, bring its to the table vis-a-vis the utility.
All right. Thank you for that. Okay. So we have two more conference calls in the next couple of days. Tomorrow is procedure for encouraging reluctant utilities to adopt renewable energy. I'm sure nobody can relate to that one. And it's a case study in Kentucky of the Kentucky Municipal Energy Agency, and Andy McDonald will be the person from FOG who will be presenting primarily on that one. And then on Thursday, same time, noon Eastern, both days, electric vehicle advancement and some role in electrification. And so we have a person we haven't seen for a while here, Ron Kamen, will be talking about that from New York. And Bob Perry, Chris Kirik will be on the panel, and Tom Cabot. So hope to see you all then. Thanks, everybody, for coming. Thanks for the panel for an excellent discussion, and we'll see you next time. Keep looking for my emails, please. You should be getting them about an hour before the event. If you don't, let me know, because sometimes they get caught in spam filters and I don't know it. So thanks again.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. Have a good afternoon, everyone.
Bye-bye. Thank you.